I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Katrina Vermette joins me now. The award-winning writer and poet is out today with her third collection of poetry, Procession. The poems are heartfelt, cognizant of the past and the present with an eye to the future. She explores the connections we have with one another, whether they're friends, families, or nations. She lovingly remembers those she loved and those that loved her. The collection also focuses the reader on how finite our time is, and ours aren't the only lives. For example, we're part of something bigger, something that's gone on long before and hopefully will go on long after we've left. I found the collection thoughtful as well as fun. When she looks back at thoughts or writing from when she was a child, there's often a laugh, a lot of wisdom, and something thought-provoking. She's taken that insightful disposition into her more contemporary works as we think about what we see when we see photographs, especially how they shape memory more often than not, especially how they shape memory more often than we'd like to concede. I enjoyed being amongst her poetry in Procession because I was seeing the parade of memories as I read of all the people I've encountered, good and bad, but mainly good. Though, as you'll hear us discuss, there are some people who might even warrant a good fuck you. Katrina Vermette received the Governor General's Literary Award for Poetry for her first book, North End Love Songs. Her novel, The Break, won many awards and was a bestseller. She holds an MFA from the University of British Columbia. She is a Red River Métis writer from Treaty One Territory. Her father's roots run deep in this land, dating back over two centuries, and her mother's side is Mennonite. This new collection is from House of Anansi Press. She joined me from Winnipeg 2.5 weeks ago. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Katrina Vermette. Dr. Vermette, good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm not really a doctor, though. I'm not supposed to say that.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't call people unless they're medical. But anyway, I just saw that in your bio, and I thought, you know, you earned it. You deserve it, I guess.
I also read
in the bio that you have an MFA from UBC. I can't remember now. With an MFA, did you live here for the period of time that you were, say, working on it?
No. I visited for, like, summer sessions, and I do go to Vancouver whenever I can. I live
there. So you'd live, because there's another poem in the collection where you refer to, say, living in Surrey during the early 80s?
Yeah. It's weird. I've been in Vancouver kind of off and on when I was a kid. When I was very young, we lived in Surrey, like 1980, we lived in Surrey for a year. When Mount St. Helens erupted, we were there. And then in the late 90s, I kind of did some couch surfing for a few years in Vancouver. So now it's just kind of like this second home place that I always like to visit every few months. And every time it looks completely different. No, during the MFA, I only did the optional residency option. So I did everything online, and I only came in for a couple weeks in the summer.
You said something that, you know, I've lived here my whole life, and I still can't get over that fact. You know, when I talk to people that visit here regularly that have lived here before, that's one of the first things they talk about is how different or how quickly things change here.
Every single time. I was actually there just a few weeks ago in the summer for the first time in probably a couple years. And already there were, like, I mean, so that was actually the longest stretch I've had for a while. Uh-huh. But there were so many things that I remember. You also, like, memory is also tricky in that way. Like, we always remember things a little bit differently. But there's so much new that is always happening in Vancouver. The beaches always look the same, though. I always go back to the beaches because the beaches, the parks, I know where I am.
Yeah. One of the things that I enjoyed about the, well, I enjoyed a lot of things about the collection, but what I did as I was reading that I liked a lot was, because I take notes when I read, especially if I have to do an interview on the book, it made me think of, it made me go beyond, say, what I was reading and made me think about, because you're talking about specific people in your life, specific situations. It made me think about my own, it made me think of my grandmother. It made me think of where I am in my life. We're about the same age. it made me think about this time of life, looking back, but also looking ahead. And I couldn't help but think that that was something that you were thinking about as you were, say, putting this collection together.
Absolutely. And I think that's always the right response, especially for something as reflective as poetry, is that we're not only thinking about the experience on the page, but how it relates to us, right? Very much, it's like, it feels like a midlife book in my head. It's my third book of poetry, so it feels like a continuation of the poetry in a lot of ways. But here, I'm at this place where I have young children. I also have aging parents. I really feel like I'm conscious of the generation that's coming up behind me. I have older kids who are in their 20s and just what they're experiencing and how their lives are changing and how much further along they are than I was at that age, which is remarkable. But also really thinking about what's been left behind for me, you know. There's an adage in the book, and it's an old teaching that I've often referred to in the book, is that we're only here to honor our ancestors and make space for our children, our variations of that. And I really feel like that's a midlife place where you're very, very conscious of where you've come from and where you're going, and who you come from, yeah, and who you leave behind, whether that's, and I'm not talking like bio children. I'm talking about the generation behind us that hopefully we've left something good for them, you know?
Yeah, I guess we're so wrapped up in, say, getting through the day that we forget that we're really, you know, a part of something bigger, because the dedication of the book is for those who came before and those who came after. We tend to think, you know, let's just get through, you know, make sure we have enough for retirement and all that stuff. But, you know, we really are leaving, hopefully, a better place behind,
hopefully,
right?
A better place, yeah. And I mean, and also, like, both things are true. Hopefully we can survive during retirement, and hopefully we also have left behind something. You know, I think, what is it? As long as you leave behind something good,
yeah,
you know, as long as,
yeah,
it's less horrible than it was before you, which is harder and harder these days to, like, you know, hopefully leave something worthwhile. Like, both things are true. It's kind of hard to, I mean, it really puts in perspective when you think about, I do a lot of work and have done a lot of work in the past recently, and just thinking about my ancestors, you know, 3-4 generations before me, and how different their lives have been from mine, but also how similar, you know, we all, you know, I come from a line of mothers who, you know, really, either by, like, however they acquired their children, whether by birth or adoption or whatever, you know, they were really invested in their well-being. And as part of this collection, too, I became a mother again. Well, I've been a mother for a long time, but I had young children during the course of this. So it was really recognizing that, you know, lifelong vocation of giving back, paying forward kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing that struck me as I was reading the book, is that we inherit so much.
Mm-hmm.
For trauma, for example. You know, some of us, we don't even know what transfers to us that we have to contend with.
Yeah.
Do you think we're better at understanding just how much of our past shapes who we are or where we are, say?
I don't know. I never know about better or worse or whatever. I think we're definitely, like, you know, when it comes, this movement over the last few years around, you know, therapeutic approaches and psychology and kind of making this space for discussion around mental illness and mental health, I think it's been really eye-opening in how we connect our flaws with our flaws and our challenges with things that come before us, you know. And I'm thinking here about, like, childhood traumas and intergenerational traumas, where mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of things we inherit through no fault of our own that actually, you know, kind of causes habits and reactions in us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really good to have, like, an intellectual understanding of that. But I also think it doesn't matter. Like, I mean, intellectual understanding is not, you know, overcoming. It's not healing. You know, it's not like, you know, a physical or spiritual, if you will, like, you know, recovery. So, I mean, I think, whereas I think in our, if we think about previous generations, they maybe had no understanding of that whatsoever, but they maybe had more of a rooting onto, you know, land-based practices, maybe rooting into ceremony or spiritual practices. Like, they are just like a quieter life where maybe they were able to, you know, have a different frame of contemplation. You know, I think there is still health there. A lot of health practices I think we would probably benefit from. But not to say that three or four generations didn't have an immense amount of suffering and difficulty and, you know, all the other things that accompanied life 100 plus years ago. But I think they had their strengths as well.
Yeah, that's the other thing that as you were just talking there that I was thinking about is people in the past have say a problem or problems. The fact that I'm here, for example, is an example, say, of some level of strength, I guess, right?
And, absolutely. Yeah. I think that intergenerational, whenever we talk about intergenerational trauma, per se, which seems to be the catchphrase, I always like to flip that around and say, as much as we've inherited the trauma, we've inherited the strength. Yeah. And you know they were strong people because they survived enough to continue their line.
Yeah.
How I don't know how much strength it really takes to, you know, to really pass on a line. But, I mean, we're still here. We're here because of whatever they did.
Well, you said something a moment ago that I'm still thinking about. And that is knowing that, there is still work to be done, though, right? I mean, it's one thing to know about what we might inherit, but to say understand that or overcome it better, there's work involved in that, right?
There's always work involved in that, and I think this is maybe it's a midlife thing, maybe it's a, I don't know what it is, but it's a me thing right now where it's this realization, like, I really intellectualized my experience my whole life, and I really, like, I'm a writer, so I like to write things, and I like to look at things that I've written and kind of figure, like, you know, I used to always say as a kid that I didn't know what I was feeling until I wrote it down and read it back to myself.
Yeah.
But really what that says, and I mean, in a way that says, yay, writing's awesome. But also it means that I'm just intellectualizing my experience. I'm not actually feeling it because I was so, you know, for various reasons in my life, I didn't necessarily know what I was feeling or kind of have, you know, that emotional reality in my body. Yeah, I mean, so there is one thing to, like, intellectualize and know why you do something or know why you're so messed up or, you know, why you have this, you know, habit that you inherited from your ancestors. But then to know that you can heal from that and to know that you don't have to have this. It's not just because we inherit these things doesn't mean they're, you know, a death sentence or a life sentence, as it were, you know. Just like any physical symptoms, any diseases we might, you know, inherit in our genes, like there's challenges in that, but it's not something we have to just simply accept. You know, we can figure out how to live with it and, you know, maybe how to even overcome it.
I talk to writers all the time, and one of the things I'm fascinated by is that feeling that they have when they're particularly productive, when they're, say, in the zone, if you will. I'm sure you've experience that where you're writing and you're trying to get it down as quickly as you can. When you're in that place of say great inspiration, because there's a beautiful line in the poem
Anishinaabe Moen.
Yeah, which is a great line which is a great title for a poem. Yeah, where you write, it has flowed within me even when I don't understand, referring to language.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably talking about language, but in terms of writing itself, I mean, I'm sort of interpreting from that sometimes you can get struck by inspiration, What does that feel like for you when you're particularly productive, say?
Well, first of all, thank you for that reading of that poem, because yeah, it was very literal in the language, in the Anishinaabemowin language, which was the language of my ancestors, and but not of the last few generations. But it very much is that same language, is like how what we put onto our experience, and we don't always understand that. For me, I always think of, when I think of the inspiration or whatever it is that compels us, and I do think it's kind of a compulsion. I think, like, as much as it's this beautiful spiritual experience, it's just kind of like this obsession that we get as writers, as artists or creators, where we have to. Mm. And the have to is, I almost feel like I'm always trying to outrun the last thing I wrote. You know, like,
yeah.
Whether that's a vulnerability that I shared, or I'm just yabbing my whole career. Like, every time I write a book, I'm like, yeah, but this.
Yeah,
but this. Like, yeah. So I'm really just, I'm talking, and I don't know if that is, like, what that comes from. And I don't consider myself a terribly talkative person, but I guess I really, really have a lot to say. But I feel like I'm always trying to just continue on this dialogue that I'm essentially having with myself. But I do think, I always think of something Richard Van Camp says about ghosts. Is it him that says ghosts? Richard Wagamese says something very similar too, about, like, kind of, these are deliveries from our ancestors. You know, these are things that are kind of like put onto us.
Yeah.
I think Richard Van Camp said ghosts, and Richard Wagamese said deliveries from ancestors. I remember him speaking about it with this gesture of like pulling something down from the sky kind of thing. And it does, so I always think of that, because I do think that things, I mean, I craft them. I spend a lot of time plying the trade and really trying to write things properly. But there is an element of the story that's just kind of gifted to us, you know?
Yeah.
And we don't know where it comes from. And it's kind of magical. And aren't we so lucky that we get to have it? And poems are the same. Poems are most definitely the same. There's a rhythm and a cadence to poems, each individual poem, that just kind of presents itself. You know, often think that it's from my ancestors and all of those people before me that didn't have this luxury of being able to write it and get paid to write it.
Yeah, I would think it'd be, as someone who doesn't write, I would think it would be exciting at that moment to get that connection from, whether it's creativity or the past especially, to sit there and just be moved by that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all get it. I also, you know, my other opinion of writers is that, like, or all artists, is that I don't think we're particularly special. I think we just kind of got obsessed with something and keep going with it. I think everybody can tap into that, whether it be, you know, like, I don't know who it was that said that everybody has one book in them, but most writers only have one book in them, you know, or something like that. But everybody yeah. has the ability to tap into whatever that is, that story, that source, that whatever. I mean, there's so many things in our daily lives that we do that are creative and inspired. I don't think there's any, like, we're not, I think we all can have access to that.
Yeah, I guess listening is a thing that I've learned that's important when you interview people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure, because you refer to your grandmothers through the collection, and listening to them, you know, not just growing up, say, that's yielded some great wisdom for you, hasn't it? I mean, when they talk about their dreams, for example, dreaming about their future, I mean, that may not have struck you as useful at the time, but certainly now at this point in your life, you find wisdom in that. I certainly did as a reader when you talk about that in the collection.
Isn't that special? Oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah, I found that quite useful in a way, if you will.
Isn't that special? That was kind of, I lost my grandmother's relatively early. I was 13 when my mamère died, and 24, 25 when my grandma died. But I do remember that these weird superstitious stories that, like, she told me and that my aunties told me and my mom after her, just these things that, you know, it was always told in a very nonchalant way. Like, yeah, we can, sometimes the future's in your dreams. You just have to pay attention to it. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, like, this is something totally normalized.
Yeah.
But what a gift, like, that passed down through, like, how long has that been in amongst these women, you know? Because these were all my mother's people. So these are all Mennonite women. So for many generations, they were in very strict religious communities.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to have any kind of superstition, any kind of dream teaching, is actually quite remarkable. But it was so commonplace when we were little, just to talk about it. What a gift, eh?
Indeed. Who is it in your family that you write about that love Coronation Street?
Oh, my mamère, grandma, my dad's mom.
Yeah, and she knew everything about all the characters. And, you know, I often tell people that, you know, I'll remember obscure characters from TV shows.
Yep.
But I won't remember, you know, say the name of their spouse or or friends' kids' names. But it's funny how as you listen to these things or watch these things as a kid or a young person even, and then these certain names stay with you, don't they?
Yeah, they stay with you, and the stories stay. See, my problem is I won't remember your birth date, where you work, anything like that. But if you told me a story, or I remember some like obscure fact, like your kid loved the color blue, and so you did, you know, whatever, some like whatever story that is, and it doesn't even have to be obscure. It can be mundane.
Yeah.
But I remember people through story, and I think we do. I think that's what many of us do is remember people through, or remember things through story and whatever kind of, like, emotional connection we have with that.
Mm. Yeah, you mentioned the name Joey Jeremiah in one of the poems. And I sort of remember the name, but then I had to look it up because I wasn't too sure where I remembered that name from. And then, you know, when I Googled it, I realized where was
and
that.
And then you're like, of course, Joey Jeremiah and his jean jacket. Yeah. that was historic. That was the icon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a friend once. Okay, this is a friend once, like 1990, and she was at some sort of an event here in Winnipeg, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the actor who played Joey Jeremiah was there, and she got a photo. And, oh, my gosh, she rode that popularity wave for, like, months. Joey Jeremiah was a moment. We should.
Yeah. A number of poems in the collection evoke the imagery of photography, and not just the memory of, say, the pictures we take, but also the parts of the camera that do the work. My mind was certainly focused on what captivates us about photography, how it shapes memory, and, say, the meaning of what's captured in the image. Because, you know, like everybody else, you must have photos of yourself with other people that you don't even remember.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, seeing yourself in, you know, recently or in the past even, that shapes the memory of say, that moment. Are poems like pictures for you when you read them back?
They are, yeah. And thinking about, as you're talking, I do have a lot of poems about photos and photographs. I think every collection I have some sort of, you know, photo. I have this kind of obsession with photography, and which is funny because, like, it's like I like to talk about art forms and write about art forms that I'm really actually very bad at. So I like to talk about photography in that way, just as a total fan. But poems, yeah, they definitely, like, anything I've written, I can remember the feelings associated with it. I can remember, like, the machinations of whatever went into it, particularly with poems, because in poems you think you're being cryptic. You know, like, the poet always thinks so highly of themselves, and they think, oh, I'm putting things together, and I'm making comparisons. I'm painting pictures, and I'm being all, you know, fanciful in my words, as if no one's going to be able to know what it actually means. But of course, the whole point of the poem is that everyone knows exactly what it means. Maybe not exactly, you know, maybe not the facts, but you know, you're evoking a feeling, but you're thinking, you're hiding. But whenever I read a poem, I can tell you exactly what I was thinking, what I was getting at. And I almost feel like I often laugh at myself especially at poems that I wrote years ago, mm-hmm. because they seem so juvenile now. Because I'm like, oh, I was trying to be smart with that little turn of phrase, but I know exactly what I was going there. But yeah, it's fun. It's kind of like a conversation with my younger self. Mm-hmm. Only they're not listening.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about is because we take so many more photos today than say 25 years ago because of our phones and the sort. Do you think that changes how our memories are shaped? I mean, I was wondering as I was reading one poem if because of the ubiquity of the photography around us, mm-hmm. is there something lost now in the sort of style or the art of photography as a result?
Well, see, I don't think so. I mean, when you think of the poem or the photos that like shape you, like the photos that you know, they're the ones that you like have framed in your house. They're the ones you look at all the time. So this is with all the pictures that are taken right now, I really wonder how many of them we get to look at with that intensity, you know? Like I'm thinking like baby books. I had baby books printed up for my little kids.
Yeah.
And they love to look at them. And those are the photos they're going to remember. Not the hundreds that are still on my laptop, you know, that most of them they've never seen. So I wonder like how much, like they're not going to have any effect on them. And they're not really doing anything other than taking up space in my cloud, you know, and being the rejects for the baby book, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's funny to me, like I think we're still, like as much as we have so much more photos, we still have like kind of, you know, maybe the same amount of photos, because I still like, I like printed photos, I like framed photos around my house, so I usually do a handful of those a year. I might print some up for grandparents kind of thing. And
yeah.
So we kind of, I mean, maybe we have in the end, we have the same amount of photos, you know, because there's always like that photo that you really love, you know. I've had lots of pictures taken of me over the last like 10 plus years or so. But most of them I hate because I don't like pictures of myself. But there's a few I like, and those ones I have. And those are the ones that I like to look at and remember, you know. Not the ones that aren't unflattering, you know. I don't want to give that any space, you know. But, yeah, I think we have this natural, like, curation of our lives in that way where we just, yeah, there's certain photos that we love, and those are the ones that we either frame or return to or have as our screensavers, and those are the ones that stay in the memory, you know.
Yeah, indeed. The other thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the collection, there's a poem where you ask a question that I wish I asked earlier, that if God is so loving, why would he care about worship? And mm-hmm. there's another line in that poem where if we give thanks to God for good things, why don't we admonish him for the bad? And I wish as a kid when I grew up Catholic, when I didn't want to go on Sunday mornings to that place, I kind of wish I asked that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, wasn't that like? I mean, kudos. Those were honestly those thoughts. I mean, I didn't necessarily have that precise language on it, but those were the questions I was thinking about, like as 12 years old, and I don't know why. I mean, I was a very critical kid. So I don't know if it was necessarily a good thing. But, yeah, I just remember calling BS on the whole thing. And in such a big way. And, I mean, I also, like, I understand, I think the bonuses of and the brilliance of things like church and any kind of spiritual you know, practices like that is really the gathering together and the ceremony and the ritual of it all.
Yeah.
I think those are really brilliant.
Yeah.
So depending on your belief system, I think belief system is almost skills secondary to just that gathering together and doing something in a really meaningful, beautiful way. I think that can be wonderful. But for me, I was, just this little mini little wannabe theologian who was just like, what the heck is up with this? I also remember really, like, thinking about that if God really wanted to make the world better, he would have made Jesus a little brown girl. Mm.
Yeah.
And so people would treat little brown girls better, which now thinking back as like an almost 50-year-old, you know, kind of like doing what I do, I'm like, wow, yeah, I mean, I was certainly going through something at the same time, too,
yeah.
You know? It's interesting. I would welcome real theologians having those conversations
exactly.
with me. I would love that. Like, I have total respect for Christianity, and I grew up in a Mennonite Brethren church and also an evangelical church. Neither of which I'm. That is not my belief system, but I respect. I'd be interested to know how that turned out for everyone else.
I certainly think the asking the question, and say somebody in you know somebody whose job it is to say be a minister or you know be part of a church, you know whose vocation that is. I think that there's great work there for that, and maybe if they tackled the question publicly, or you know did the work, you know the thinking work, you know they might make converts of some people, right?
There you go. Maybe I've given some, you know, some theology undergrad their topic, paper topic.
Exactly. Right
here or something.
Yeah.
Go forth and multiply.
Yeah. There's a poem to your sister that I've been thinking about several days now after reading it. The writer Teresa Kishkin, she was on the show. A couple of years ago now, I guess, and she was talking about she had a relative's ashes, and she put them in these plastic containers, and she and her family took it to a river or an ocean or something to put the ashes in there. So you tell your sister to take that you're pretty low maintenance about what happens when it comes to your remains. to take your ashes and put them in recycled jars for your kids to put in a river or ocean. Teresa's written something similar to that. So I asked her when she was on the show what they did with the containers afterwards. Because, I mean, here you are. You're taking your loved one's ashes in, you know, it's great that, you know, you're using, in your case, you want jars. What are you going to do with the jars afterwards? I mean, do you toss the jar into the ocean, you know, after the ashes? Or you can't reuse them for anything, right?
Well, I mean, maybe you shouldn't, but also, why not? I have the kind of house where I have tons of recycled jars of all sorts.
Yeah, yeah.
Of varying states of, like, you know, the label peeled off.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, who knows? I hope it's, like, it's a decent jar.
Yeah.
And if they want to keep it and, like, put flowers in it, sure. If they want to keep it to, like, can some tomatoes, I would not be offended by that. But I don't know what you do. Like, I don't know. I also really, I like jars. I like putting stuff in jars. Like, there's something precious about that. Maybe they can... I mean, maybe they'd want to sanitize it.
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
In between the tomatoes and the mother. but that's totally their call.
Yeah. See, I when I read Teresa, because she said it was recycled plastic containers. So, I don't know, ice cream containers or cheese, you know, a butter thing that the butter comes or margarine comes in.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, it's great, you're using that. But, I mean, your loved one was in that, so you just toss it into the garbage can as you leave the park? I mean, I don't...
Just recycle it?
Yeah.
Just like, you know, yeah.
I like your idea of the glass jars, though. I think that's
good. Yeah, nice glass jar. Nice glass jar, you know. Well, that's actually a step up in my family, high maintenance-wise, because my dad always said, just put them in a coffee can. So I'm like, I'm pretty fancy with my glass jar.
Yeah. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the collection because I found there was you know, as I said a moment ago, there was something useful that I'm able to take, you know, with myself as I finish the collection. I found something wise, obviously, in it. Mm-hmm. When you go back and you reread, you know, even thoughts that you had as a 12-year-old in those pink binders, or not binders, but notebooks,
Hillroy,
that you got.
Yeah.
Did you find something that you've yielded something useful for yourself?
Always, yeah. I mean, like, there's always something. Sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's just sad. I mean, but like in that good sad, like, you know, very cute. I'm old enough now to be able to look back on most parts of my life, you know,
mm-hmm.
With almost like a maternal, you know, kind of compassion to that person who was, you know, just trying her best most of the time. And that's especially easy when you're a child, right? Because, you know, not so much easy when I was in my 30s, you know. That compassion's a little slower to come by, but, you know, now I think of, I really think of my own kids, my own nieces and nephews, and mm-hmm. how much they struggled, how young they were at that age. Like, you think we're so old when we're in our teens, and then you actually watch a teenager and you realize they're babies. I have a lot more compassion for her now. So now she's my younger self, mm-hmm. that I hearkened a bit in this book. Yeah, I can see where she was going. I can see what she was doing with that.
Yeah. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the collection, and it made me remember some of the you know, some of the people that I hadn't thought about in a while that deserve thinking about. It also made me realize that some of the decisions I made sort of validated, you know, that we can move on from a lot of stuff, but yeah, you know, there's certain people, you know, who deserve that fuck you, you know?
They really do. And they do, and it's a forever fuck you.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's carved in stone.
Yeah, indeed. Katrina, I so appreciate your time today. This is a wonderful collection. Congratulations and good luck with it. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you so much, Marcy. My pleasure.
The book is called Procession. It's published by House of Anansi Press. Its author, Katrina Vermette, joined me on the line from Winnipeg in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.